Welcome to the France 24 debate as US-led talks with Russia and Ukraine progress. You can put that in inverted commas, but without the Europeans at the table, and that is a fact, the 27-nation bloc is pressing ahead with what Ursula von der Leyen has branded a steel porcupine strategy. Her words, we need to make Ukraine strong enough to be indigestible for potential invaders. She's clearly thinking of Vladimir Putin. Her plan aims to build the Ukrainian armed forces and the country's defense industry into a formidable opponent for Russia to give Ukraine a hope of self-defense in the future. Well, we'll be getting all the thoughts of our panel, but let's first hear from Ukraine's president, who's been on a long journey today. He's speaking in Oslo, Volodymyr Zelensky.
We need to continue pressure Russia so that Putin stops manipulations and makes the concrete steps that all the world wants. And in particular, one of the first steps must be a silence. And now we discuss it with the United States of America and other partners. Silence in the sky, the cessation of strikes on energy sector and on civilian infrastructure and people, ceasefire at sea.
Volodymyr Zelensky, of course, speaking there in Norway, where he met with Norway's leader. Earlier, he'd spoken to both the EU summit and the meeting of the defence chiefs of staff, which took place in London. The broader issue, of course, is the whole defence of Europe. Where do we stand with that? Here to discuss, then, the defence of the continent and all matters relating. Here in the studio, Manlio Graziano, Professor of Geopolitics at Sciences Po and La Sorbonne. Sir, thank you for being with us. Great to see you.
Thank you.
Joining us by Skype from the Netherlands in The Hague is Julia Soldatjuk-Vesterveld, Senior Research Fellow, Europe and Global Affairs at Klingendahl Institute for International Relations. Thank you for joining us. Here in the studio is Victor Wahem, who's a fellow at the Joint European Disruptive Initiative, or JEDI. Victor, great to see you and thanks for joining us. And last but not least, from Brussels is Maria Tadio, Europe correspondent for Grand Continent. Thank you all for being with us here in the France 24 debate. Julia, can I start with you over there in Brussels at the Grand Continent? Of course, this is where the conversation began today with the European summit. Give us your sense about what happened there, about what is actually happening next. I'm sorry, Maria, over to you.
Yes. Look, I think this is a summit that is obviously ongoing. The conclusions on Ukraine, as you know, when you have summits like this, the EU 27 leaders get together and they have to endorse texts, which essentially give the political direction that the Commission should then take over. I think what we've had already is an agreement on those conclusions, which are very similar to the ones that were approved 2 weeks ago. Again, the European Union reiterates they will stand with Ukraine. They also insist that nothing about Ukraine should be negotiated without Ukraine, but they also say that nothing about European security can be discussed or would be effective without the Europeans. Obviously, all of this goes into play with the idea that President Trump is now handling this negotiation and the Europeans are not around the table. Obviously, the one exception has been Viktor Orban. I think for a lot of European diplomats by now, they really understand that going forward, they cannot count on Hungary. A number of European diplomats also told us, frankly, at this point, it's better to just work as a coalition of the willing of countries that really want to support Ukraine rather than to water down our initiatives because of Hungary. But I think the bigger question that's still in everyone's minds, and I think that's something that Volodymyr Zelensky told European leaders when they met virtually at the summit earlier in the day, is whether or not Russia means business when they say they want to aim for a credible ceasefire. The Ukrainian president told the European leaders that he believes that is not the case, that Russia is not sincere when it comes to the ceasefire, let alone peace. And he also insisted the fact that there's a diplomatic effort doesn't mean that we should remove the pressure on Russia, and obviously that means the sanctions.
Maria, is there a sense that the mood in Europe it has changed immensely? Obviously, since Donald Trump decided to do what he did, but clearly in the wake of what Vladimir Putin is doing in Ukraine.
Well, the mood has certainly changed immensely over the past 3 years. Obviously, the victory of President Trump made that change even more significantly, I would argue. Of course, we all remember, I'm sure you'd remember this in the studio very well, that situation, for the lack of a better word, between President Trump and President Zelensky. It was a very heated moment. We also know that the United States is willing to be tough in the negotiation when it comes to removing perhaps some of the aid for Ukraine, if that's what it takes or would take to get them at the table. So the Europeans now know that this is an administration that behaves in a very different way. And that also means that at this point, the Biden doctrine, this idea that Europe and the United States would move together, no longer exists in a number of ways. We should note, however, that the European Union still continues to say the U.S. is an ally and we will have to work with them. They also know and accept that any credible deal will have to include the U.S. in some shape, but they also know that they will now have to do more when it comes to the money, the financing, the weapons, and potentially, of course, there's the biggest question of all, which is troops on the ground and this coalition of the willing when it comes to putting soldiers that could protect this eventual peace treaty if we get to that point. What I would stress, however, and this is very important today, is that one of the takeaways from European leaders at this stage is that they do not believe we have entered the real negotiations. It believes that this is Vladimir Putin perhaps asking for more time, perhaps trying to play, why not say it, the Americans, trying to extract more concessions. But there is a sense that the real negotiation has not really started yet. And of course, that for that moment and when it comes, Ukraine will have to be supported heavily by the Europeans if they want to get a big say in these talks. That is now the priority for Europeans, to structure a package that can help Ukraine. But of course, that is very difficult when you talk about enormous money. Today, we talk about 20 billion euros, even 40 billion euros could be provided. Europe's own defense, all of this, of course, means a lot of heavy funding. How is that going to be articulated? And also, who is willing to do this? I think that is still the biggest question. Who is going to put soldiers on the ground, but also who is going to commit from their own budget? And obviously, that means difficult political decisions to help Ukraine.
Maria Tadiok, all bases covered. Thank you very much indeed for that very comprehensive roundup of thoughts, ideas and discussions happening in Brussels. That's Maria Tadiok, who's the Europe correspondent of Grand Continent. We'll be back to Maria very shortly to get more news of a special survey that she and her colleagues have carried out. That issue of who does what. Malo Graziano and Victor Vahem here in the studio. Can I bring you in on that? Because clearly there is a pressing need, Manlio, is there not, given what Trump is saying, given the way things are going, for Europe to really get things moving in terms of sorting out its defence?
Yeah, I was saying before when I arrived that I discovered a new word in English, spoil sport.
Spoil sport, okay.
Exactly, because I'm here playing this role.
Tell us what you think.
I'm sorry. Because really, I don't think that we can talk about a European defense. We should talk much more properly of defense of European countries,
okay,
which is different. Because Europe is not a state. It doesn't have a foreign policy. So without the foreign policy, without a clear idea of what they wanted to achieve, they cannot have an army. Because who is commanding the army if they have an army? I mean, if the army is just for a show, maybe it's possible to do it. But if you want to act, it becomes very difficult because we don't have a Europe. We have 27 countries with 27 foreign policies. And we see even now, even with this threat, for me, threat is particularly from the United States more than from Russia. But it is a threat. And even in front of the threat, there are very huge divisions among European countries. So this is why I'm skeptical about the very idea of creating a European defense, because we don't know exactly what kind of a political subject we are talking about.
And you say the threat is more from the United States than from Russia.
Yeah, I exaggerated a little bit, but that was my idea.
This is part of your spoil sport thing, carry on.
Yeah, exactly. No, my idea is that Russia doesn't represent a threat now for Europe and probably will not represent a threat in the future, because Russia is very weak, and this war showed very clearly that it's a weak country. So I don't think that they have the power to do anything more. In 3 years of war, they conquered 19.2% of the territory of Ukraine. So I don't think it's possible to do more. The problem is that today, Russia is supported by the United States, and that changes completely. Because, of course, if you are shouldered by the United States, you can do things that you were not supposed or you could not do without the support of the United States. This is why I'm saying that the United States is much more a threat today than Russia, because Russia itself alone cannot be a threat, not even, in my opinion, for the Baltic states, for Poland, for Finland.
Hear what you're saying. Manlio Graziano of Sciences Po La Sorbonne, Professor of Geopolitics. Bear with us, we'll be straight back to you. Let's cross the set. Viktor Vahem of the Joint European Disruptive Initiative, which you dub as JEDI. And one might think you need a JEDI to work out these problems without being flippant, because it is an incredibly complex situation where you have Donald Trump completely redefining what the US does in the world. Vladimir Putin emboldened by that, because Trump appears to be in awe of this authoritarian leader of Russia who waged war on Ukraine, saying he would capture the entire country in 3 days and get Volodymyr Zelensky, none of which he's achieved, of course, as our guest just pointed out. What can Europe do? Because there's points been made that it might be difficult to put together a European army to stop this. But, you know, there's been a commitment from Emmanuel Macron to maybe put troops, French troops, in Ukraine if necessary. Keir Starmer in Britain, not part of the EU anymore, but part of the European kind of like project, if you like, in that sense, has not ruled out putting British troops there, if necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this solution was raised already almost 1 year ago by Emmanuel Macron to provide support to Ukraine, in spite of the lack of funding, of course, from France and from other highly indebted countries in the EU. So to me, it's sort of a solution for the weak, if I may say, because you don't need to actually ramp up your defense industry, scale up your companies. You just need to go on the field, of course, and provide support, which also helps actually, you know, better control the aid that is being given away to Ukraine.
But you need the hardware. You need the guns. You need the ammunition. You need...
Yes, absolutely. That's why, you know, men can replace weapons to a certain extent, but not entirely, of course. Which is why the plan, you know, that was announced 2 weeks ago, Rearm Europe, €800 billion, with €150 billion of Eurobonds, in theory, and €650 billion provided by the member states, if they dare spend more, of course, because that's up to them. This will be a great opportunity, of course, to ramp up the defense industry, industrial base. And the thing is, this is, of course, the direction to take to replace, eventually, maybe the U.S., considering, you know, the support we need to provide to Ukrainians in their war against Russia. Nevertheless, when you consider the time you need to ramp up these industries in Europe, we're not talking about 6 months. We're not talking about 1 year. We're talking about 3 to 5 years, and maybe even more. And when you look at, you know, the scope, the, you know, the time span that is being given to member states to spend this excess spending in terms of defense expenditures, it's 4 years. So I think that's the horizon we need to, you know, to have in mind when we consider the eventuality of replacing the U.S. in Ukraine. And of course, this is very different to compared to having a European army, which is not on the table at all, because we do have different foreign policies. Nevertheless, you know, and this is something that I think sort of missed in the white paper on the future of European defense that was published yesterday. There is a lack of ambition in terms of common programs. You know, again, when you look at the paper, everything is sort of left to the member states to, you know, to decide, yes, let's do this and that together, etc. Although we observe today that we have so many redundant programs, you know, in terms of, I don't know, tanks on one side, planes, ammunition, etc., etc. And that could be a great rationalization, you know, in terms of programs, public supported programs in the EU. And this was not in the plan. So a bit disappointing.
People watching this in Kyiv, and we do have many people who watch us from Ukraine. Good evening and welcome to the program if you're watching from Ukraine. They must be tearing their hair out to hear these kind of things. Let's bring in Yulia Soldatyuk-Vestervelt, Senior Research Fellow for Europe and Global Affairs at the Klingendahl Institute for International Relations. Yulia, thank you for waiting patiently for your turn. You're on now. Give us your sense of the situation. Tell us what you think.
Good evening. So talking about European defense, the challenge of increasing defense spending in those countries that are less supportive of the general initiative is often connected to two things. One was already mentioned, that's a perception, the degree to which Russia is perceived as an urgent security threat to a particular country, and it's usually the case more in the eastern flank of the EU and in the north. And then the second question is what do people need to give up, cut spending on in order to finance, to increase the financing of defense? And returning back to the perception of Russia as a security threat, it might not be perceived as a threat for the from a military perspective, but it does is very active as a hybrid threat and sabotage and many of those instances and examples we have been watching and seeing over the past months.
Would that be the kind of cyber threat thing you're getting at, Julie? Kind of, you know, sort of using the internet, those kind of things?
Yes, and for example, the pipelines in the North Sea sabotaging that, but also disinformation is a major threat influencing of the previous European elections last summer and increasing polarization or playing on the issues that are already subject to polarization within the European Union. So it's a kind of long-term hidden threat that is not seen directly, but it has an impact. So, but returning to the issue of the defense spending, so there is this second, what people do need to give up in that, and that was also reflected in the messages of the European leaders at the EU summit in Brussels today. So Greece and Italy, for example, emphasized the bolstering of the EU defense. That should not be a question of only loans, but also grants to the member states. And where this joint borrowing facility to member states and also European common European instruments were stressed a lot. So there is I agree that there is EU army may be a bit far-fetched, but those joint instruments to boost defense industry are a good idea and are being considered quite a lot. So that's a political on a political kind of aspect, but there's also technical aspect to that, and that's operationalizing and bringing the regular forces to the state of the combat readiness and support domestic defense industries to optimize the manufacturing. This all will take time. It is possible, but it's also a subject to political will and support and this feeling of urgency and necessity. And from the perspective of Ukraine, what I see is that Ukraine tries to position itself and to show that it's also a contributor to the EU defense, not only the consumer. It isn't the only field where the operational, the innovative technologies, defense technologies can be tested in the field. So it really tries to show its added value to the European defense as well.
Yulia, thank you for those observations. And we'll get into that very shortly. The issue of upping defense capabilities of France, for instance, is easy to say, but it takes cash resources to get that ball rolling. Our team has this on the challenges facing the government here in France and its defense sector, with the clock ticking for Ukraine and any potential threat to Europe from Russia. France aims to raise some 5 billion euros for this task, but money, as we all know, doesn't grow on trees, and French taxpayers fear a soon-arriving pinch in their pocket in spite of President Macron's promise of no tax rises to fund defence spending.
Jacques Boyer runs a family business that has been manufacturing combat gear since World War I. More than 300 people work in his factories, churning out almost 4 million units every year. But the last time the French army ordered supplies was a year ago. Now, Jacques Boyer says he's still waiting for orders.
We're waiting for details to be determined. How much does the French army want and when? That's the plan we're waiting for.
Outside the French capital, Paris, Thales builds radars capable of detecting planes, helicopters, drones and missiles up to 500 kilometers away. Some are used by the Ukrainian army. Over the last 2 years, more than 400 people have been recruited to triple production.
We boosted production to meet growing market demand. The GM200 is tactically useful. It takes 15 minutes to get going and it only takes 10 minutes to stop it and leave the theatre of operations.
These drones, used by the Ukrainian army, are able to evade radar detection and jamming. They're built in this factory near Toulouse. This model can fit inside a backpack, weighs less than 1.5 kilograms, and takes less than a minute to put together. In 2 years, production has been quadrupled, but the owners have bigger ambitions still. They hope to build more than 10,000 units every year, up from the current level of 150.
Today, the main suppliers of drones are American, Israeli and Chinese. There aren't any European leaders. Yet we're talking about robotic flying objects, so it's essential to master this technology.
More than 200,000 people work in France's defense industry. That includes 9 industry heavyweights and more than 4,000 startups.
The idea of a drone in a backpack is making my mind boggle completely. Our guests here, I think, share my point of view. Let's though give you some statistics, which come from our correspondent in Brussels, our guest in Brussels, Maria Tadeu. Maria, I hope you're still with us. Europe correspondent of Grand Continent. We're going to go through your survey, which you put together, the Euro Bazooka poll of European citizens. 1.55% of Europeans think that there is a high risk of conflict on EU territory. Let's talk about that one first, Maria. Give us your reaction to that. Give us your sense of how that was collated.
Yeah, I think before we even go into the idea of whether or not Europeans are concerned, which clearly the surveys you alluded to this do believe it's a risk, you have to look at the survey itself, because I think that is worth really assessing. We had reached out to 9 different countries that we thought were representative of the European geography. Obviously, we know, and this is playing out in the summit today, that the idea of war, the perception of threat and risk changes largely also by geography. It's not the same if you're a direct neighbor to Russia. Russia is a very southern European country that perhaps feels there's a distance between war and yourself. But I think what we did here is we reached out to 9 different countries. We also spoke to more than 10,000 people. This is a survey that we conducted thinking perhaps could help us get a sense of what Europeans believe. And overall, when you look at the conclusions, to go back to your point, yes, 51% of Europeans believe there is a threat now, a serious threat, that there is an armed conflict or could be one in Europe. This is a massive, in my view, conclusion, and it's an incredibly important point, because what we're seeing now is that a majority, even if sure it's a slim majority, but a majority of Europeans now believe the specter of war is real, it is possible, and it can no longer be excluded. Obviously, that's a very different mindset to compare to the end of the Cold War and obviously the end of the Second World War. Remember, a lot of the ethos, especially in the European Union, has been with the idea of peace and developing a peace project. What we see now is that the Ukraine war is not just a conflict in Ukraine, but it's also now a threat and a concern for the rest of the European Union. What we also see is a change in the attitudes and the perceptions of the United States as an ally. Obviously, if we go back to the end of the Second World War, but obviously going back to the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union, there has been a sense that the United States and the European Union had become real partners and allies, obviously a very strong partnership. But that is also changing in the eyes of Europeans, where a majority now begins to think maybe perhaps President Trump, and I say President Trump because that is a determining factor in terms of the perception of the United States, means that they are no longer an ally. That's also a real question when you look at Brussels and the European debate. Should we refer to the United States as a partner country, as an ally, as a friend, or just a country that we trade and do business with? For the time being, what I would say is that even if perceptions are changing, the political line that the institutions, the Commission, obviously European leaders continue to pursue is that the United States is an ally. Obviously, President Trump has a different style, but it remains remains an ally to the European Union. But nonetheless, there is a moment in which Europe now has to think to go back to the question of strategic
Maria,
autonomy.
Maria, let me pause you there for a second, please, and bring in the guests here in the studio for a moment, if you don't mind. I think what you just said about what Europe's saying about the US is they might say something differently behind closed doors, might they? I'm sure you might agree with that one. Let me bear with you for a second. 55% of people at Manlio Graziano think there might be some kind of a threat of war here in Europe. I sense you disagree with that, but tell us what you think, please.
No, I don't disagree, because actually I've been saying that for 10 years at least. So now the European people follow me. So it changes. No,
but surely this sense has increased since the Ukraine crisis began.
Of course.
Clearly.
Yeah. But I saw the beginning of the crisis in 2015, and especially after the referendum in Great Britain. I think that it was...
You're talking Brexit.
Brexit, yeah. It was a signal that things were...
Russian influence, Russian manipulation.
The same year, Americans elected Donald Trump. So it was another sign, and so on and so forth. So it's very clear that the situation is worsening, not just in Europe, everywhere in the world. We have a proof every day. But what I was saying before is that it's not necessarily from Russia, the threat. I mean, there are threats everywhere. And if you think at the very beginning of the World War I, it was not very clear who was the friend, who was the enemy. So, especially for us Italians, because they waited for 1 year before decided who was the friend and was the enemy. But it's more or less the same. We cannot say today what is going to happen in a few months, in a few years, because the situation is so fluid that things are changing continuously. Look at the fact that people think that the United States is no longer an ally, that Trump is an enemy of Europe and something like that. This is a process that started at least 50 years ago with Jimmy Carter, when the United States for the first time looked more toward Asia than toward Europe. So,
but there's always been that sense that NATO is there, that NATO is solid.
Yes, exactly. But in
9/11, they looked straight to their allies in NATO.
That was 25 years ago. 24.
Nonetheless, it's still there.
Yeah. But things are changing, and they are changing very rapidly. I mean, there are two facts in this 24 years from September 11. One is the pivot to Asia, and the second is the election of Donald Trump and the summit of 2018, when he said that he didn't know why NATO existed. So there are two signs that the proximity from between it, Europe and the United States was becoming very, very, very weak. And this is because, in my opinion, the United States doesn't consider anymore Europe as a force and itself, if any time they...
So let me bring in Victor and Julia on the issue of Donald Trump being, as Maria pointed out, in Brussels. I think it was Maria, you said 51% of people regard Trump as a threat. Was that right, what you said,
enemy.
Maria, just very briefly, an enemy? Maria in Brussels, Trump, 51% of people said he's an enemy of Europe. You're confirming that for us for your survey. Thank you. Just pause there. Victor.
Well, yeah. Very interesting thoughts that you just expressed. Yeah, absolutely. Even though I don't completely agree, because I also think that Russia represents a real threat for Europeans. Because Russia is an authoritarian state, which by definition needs sort of a war to sustain its internal power. For its internal equilibrium, it needs external war. So,
but is Trump using the same kind of tactics, in a sense?
To come back to Trump...
Sorry to press you on that.
Absolutely. Yes, I mean, that's we can come back to Clausewitz, but war is the extension of diplomacy by other means, and also of internal affairs by other means. And of course, Trump is leveraging, you know, the Ukrainian war for its internal agenda, and also, of course, to please its MAGA base. That's pretty much the only objective, especially if he expects to have a third term, you know, because that's really in the discussion.
That's what he dreams of.
Unfortunately, I think it's not only a dream. We will see in the next years.
Victor, can I pause you and bring in Julia from the Klingendahl Institute waiting for us in The Hague? Julia Soldakjuk-Westervelt. Trump, enemy of Europe, your thoughts on that one, but also this idea that, of course, Europe building its defence, as Ursula von der Leyen has said, it's so important in the light of that.
So Trump's tactics are clearly unconventional for a diplomatic effort when you talk about negotiation. For example, if you look at what he's doing with in the context of Russia-Ukrainian war, there is a difference between his strategic objectives and strategic interests of the United States that he's following on the back of his mind, and then the way what he's saying, basically. And so his interests seem to be to reach an end of active stage of war as quickly as possible, and at least to reach a ceasefire, to ensure that the European NATO member states boost their own defense and also contribute, pay for their own defense, but also play an active role in indeed defense of Ukraine, and then so that he can get more of a more space for his own troops to be active elsewhere in Asia, for example, to defend strategic interests there. And in the long term, the idea of Ukraine is it seems that he is still committed to the preserving the sovereignty of Ukraine, and this minerals deal, for example, is meant as a intensified economic, long-term economic cooperation between Ukraine and the United States. But then what he does, he applies a pressure tactics on Ukraine, on Russia, on Europe to reach his goals quickly. And he's also, we've seen it around the Munich Security Conference, also with a speech of J.D. Vance, of the vice president of the United States, but also his team and Trump himself were issuing a lot of statements that were very far, very provocative sometimes, but also they were saying different things, and it was really difficult to understand what is actually the
critics have called it a lack of strategy, Julia.
Well, I'm not sure it's a lack of strategy. I inclined to think that this is a negotiation strategy to basically disorientate the opponents and to make it very difficult for the opponents to understand what to do next.
He has succeeded, though, Trump, hasn't he, in getting Europe to commit more to its defence spending. So credit where it's due, he's actually achieved that end.
That absolutely. That, yes. And we see that he's continuing pressure because he haven't achieved this minimal norm of NATO, contribution to the NATO defence spending as he wanted. He is less successful up until now in the talks on achieving the ceasefire. What we saw earlier this week is Ukraine was committed to the ceasefire. It was also a smart move in Jeddah. And then during the phone call, not much has actually came out of this conversation. Ceasefire on energy infrastructure is basically very much in favor for Putin, because Ukrainian ceasefire of the Ukrainian critical infrastructure energy facility has been damaged largely due to Russian attack. And then Ukraine has also impacted some damage on the Russian
oil refineries. Oil refineries being hit overnight. Julia, can I pause you there for a second and just add to what you said, of course, that whilst all that diplomacy is going on, of course, the war is still continuing. There have been drone strikes on both sides overnight. And our reporters in eastern Ukraine have shown how homes have been hit by Russian strikes there. And clearly for the people on the ground, perhaps listening to our conversation, it must be incredibly frustrating for them. Let me bring Maria back in from Brussels, the Europe correspondent of Grand Continent. Maria, tell us what your survey found about the idea of a European common army.
Yes, look, this is an incredibly
complicated question because, of course, the survey and the reason why that question features there is because you know there's a very active debate as to whether or not that would be the next frontier for the European Union. One thing we should make very clear, and this is incredibly important when you look at public opinion, is that defense continues to be a national priority and it is a national prerogative because ultimately, and the French defense minister alluded to this, when you have an army, you have soldiers that are willing to die for a cause that you tell them they have to do, but also you're talking about soldiers that die in the name of a country. In this case, it could be broader and be extended to the European Union. Obviously, that is a frontier, as I mentioned, that has never been crossed by the EU. When you look at the measures that are being put forward by the European Commission, the head of the Commission, von der Leyen, has also been very clear that at this point, that is a national competence. When you look at the nuclear shield, that idea has also been floated by Emmanuel Macron, that remains a nuclear competence. So the question now, this is a reason why we think it's very relevant, is whether or not Europeans believe that is the next stage. What we see, however, is that question, it greatly varies according to the countries that you ask. What you also see is at this point, geographically, that still matters in terms of the perception of risk. Countries like Italy and Spain have a different perception of risk compared to Denmark and Poland. Obviously, the results vary
largely
there.
What did they say in Hungary, Maria?
But again, it's a question that I think for some it's provocative.
What did they say in Hungary?
Well, Hungary has said clearly... Well, Hungary is a country that has said clearly they are not going to be sending anyone and they do not agree with this. And of course, I think the point and the attention, however, is we dedicate a lot of time to Hungary, but that doesn't really reflect what's going on politically here in Brussels. Today, every diplomat says from now on, we agree that the Hungarians are not going to be on board. They're not going to be on board with boots on the ground. They've also said drastically different to everyone else that you should now have direct talks with Russia. The European Union says that is unacceptable when it comes to sanctions. Remember, the Hungarians say that should be a part of this debate. The Europeans say they will stay on. So at this point, whether the Hungarians agree or not, I don't think it adds a lot of value to this European debate because the direction of Viktor Orban is one of saying no. I also think, and this is relevant, that for the rest of European countries, that opinion doesn't really matter at this stage because it comes down to a coalition of the willing. It's not the EU27 that's going to help Ukraine. It will be those countries that want to do it. And those namely, of course, go back to France and the UK. I think a country that is relevant, however, would be Italy. Remember, the head of the Italian government, Giorgia Meloni, has said that she finds this very strange, that she does not agree and that you're not going to see any Italian soldiers in Ukraine. So, of course, as I mentioned, this is a survey we did in 9 countries, but it changes drastically among the different member states.
Maria, thank you so much for giving us that clarity on the situation. Those interesting figures you've really illuminated for us there. Maria Taddeo from the Grand Continent Europe correspondent of that journal. Manlio Graziano. Professor of Geopolitics, Sciences Po, La Sorbonne, Italian citizen. Giorgia Meloni.
It was not my purpose to be Italian citizen. I was born there, so I didn't do on purpose. But yes, I'm not surprised at the position of Giorgia Meloni because it's her position to navigate not only in international politics, but also in internal politics. Mm. And there is another party even farther right, which is the Lega. And they are pro-Russians, very clearly. So she needs... But I think that...
Her stance was expected to be pro-Russia. It turned out not to be pro-Russia. It was pro-Ukraine.
Because she's smart. and she knew that it was the only way to... But the problem with Italy is not just... with Giorgia Meloni, always been waiting for understanding who is the strongest one. And then they choose. And they go with the strongest one. So probably Meloni is just waiting for another step of this situation. But the main problem, in my opinion, is not this usual issue that Italians have, but the fact that... Italy doesn't have the money. And the problem...
Does anybody have the money? That's
exactly,
one of the big questions, isn't
exactly.
It?
I was saying the same problem for France. But France is trying to... We followed what Macron said last week, and it's like La Patrie en danger, another time. And this is something that mobilizes the French. It doesn't mobilize Italians. It's a huge difference. So I don't know where French will find the money they need, and they say they need. But I'm absolutely sure that Italians are very cautious about engaging themselves in spending more money because, of course, you know that Italy is the second in Europe for their GDP on debt on GDP. So I think that this is a problem. And the problem is with not just with the Lega and other parties, is with the voters. Because if you... voters understand that to pay for the defense, you have to reduce the expenditure for healthcare, for a school, for infrastructures, I doubt that they are convinced. This is why there is this rhetoric about the imminent threat against Europe. And Macron was
that
very
is,
good.
Is this, dare I suggest, a ploy, a kind of smokescreen? You're saying that basically the threat isn't as big as that is, but
I think that there is
somehow soften the blow.
There is a threat, and the threat is the fact that Europe was under the American umbrella has been for 80 years, and now it's over. This is over. So this is the real threat. But we don't know if the threat is coming from Russia or from somewhere else. This is the what I'm saying. But there is a threat for Europe. For the European countries, because Europe, again, I don't know what we are talking about, but for European countries, this is a problem. This is a problem because they are naked now in front of the possible risk that are looming around the world, I would say. Without the protection of the United States, and they are not ready, especially Italy, Germany, and the countries that spent less and less for defense.
My love, thank you very much. I'm out of time, but I've got to get two final comments. Julia, I'll bring you in first from The Hague. Do you agree with what Manuel has just said about Europe basically being naked in front of the threat, that basically enough hasn't been spent and it's going to take a long time to actually make up that gap?
Well, I would like to relativate it a little bit, because Europe still has a really solid base, NATO base, and it lacks some capacity, operational capacity, that was reliant on the United States and, of course, the nuclear deterrence. That part is coming from the United States, but still in its base. And now with the developments, we see that there's the meeting of five defense, largest defense spenders, ministers of that meeting in Paris last week, and the steps that were taken, the things that were discussed there, They bring a bit of optimism that it's possible to reform and to improve, you know, those gaps in Europe's defense that are now identified. And on a positive note, for Europe, this past 3 years were a wake up call, but also they had time to look and learn and to prevent that such a scenario. There is certainly a threat, I agree on that. But there is also a time and an opportunity to mitigate the threat and to prepare.
Julia, thank you very much indeed. Victor, final word to you. Is this going to be enough for Ukraine? Is this going to be enough in time for Ukraine?
So Ukraine basically has 6 months to 1 year, you know, ceteris paribus, if the conflict evolves as it evolves right now, you know, in terms of... bombing, in terms of ammunition expenditures, etc. If the U.S. stops the military aid right now, so for sure the EU is not able to replace the American supply within that time span. Nevertheless, it doesn't mean that Ukraine doesn't have solutions, because there are countries outside Europe. So when we are in this, you know, building up process of a brand new European defense industry, we can ask the Japanese, the Koreans, and other countries, Australia,
even
New Zealand, Turkey, of course. And if there is a real, you know, willingness to sort of help Ukraine fight Russia, and I think the meeting last week, it was last week, with 31 countries, except the US, of course, in Paris, actually showed that there is this willingness among basically all democracies except the US to support Ukraine. So, actually, you know, I don't know if you've watched...
Have you watched
Braveheart? I'm just going
to
finish with that.
Very quickly, go ahead.
So you know that in Braveheart, William Wallace dies because of freedom, which is stupid, because if he would have done politics, he would be alive. But the next thing is that this death actually triggers the willingness of the Scots to fight for their own freedom, which means that, you know, supporting Ukraine for freedom does mean something. And I mean, if there is this willingness to support, you know, Western freedom and our values, I'm sure we're going to find a solution.
Viktor Vahm, thank you very much indeed from the Joint European Disruptive Initiative. Thanks also to Manlio Graziano here in the studio, Professor of Geopolitics at Sciences Po and La Sorbonne. And thanks to our guests joining us from afar, Julia Soldatiuk-Vesterveldt from the Klingendahl Institute and the star of the show from Brussels, Maria Taddeo, Europe correspondent for Grand Continent. Thank you all for taking part. Thank you all for watching. Stay with us here on France 24.